The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
These kinds of interventionist behavior on the parts of central banks all around the world, this is where gold gains traction again, where people say, you can't make heads and tails out of interventionism, and the only way to hedge against a blow-up is to have some exposure to something that will last even when the dust settles.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I've got you on the line here in South Africa. I have to say, this brings back memories. When I first came to work for your dad back in 1987, you were taking trips with your father to South Africa. I think he ended up going over there over 30 times in just a few years. But you've had a few trips over there yourself. Now, you're there with your son. Boy, it seems like all things come around.
You know, it's been almost 30 years, I think, just in that neighborhood, between 25 and 30 years since I've been in this country. And a lot of things have changed in some respects. And in other respects, nothing's changed at all. And we'll discuss that a little bit. But it's a fascinating place to be at this point in time where you've got emerging markets, which would include, you know, Brazil currently in a recession, near depression, Russia, who's been struggling financially. We've got China, who is facing massive, massive shifts in terms of politics and power struggles inside the country, and South Africa. And these are your BRICS. These are what Goldman Sachs created an acronym for as the countries which would redefine not only the emerging markets, but the global economy.
Well, and I think we should probably talk about why you're there, Dave. You were asked to present a paper on economics, a white paper on economics, for a group of very successful economists, businessmen, people who are known worldwide for actually going and doing and making a difference.
Yeah, it was an interesting summit environment where some of the best and brightest from the business community from 25 different countries in six continents were there to discuss development issues, poverty issues, educational issues, best practices as it relates to entrepreneurship, and many of the things which these practitioners in the trade of business believe are door openers for a new tomorrow and a better tomorrow. When we look at the strains that we see on the global economy, there are doers, and this was a group of doers. So my paper was to look at business cyclicality and to look at the ebbs and flows in the marketplace, both the financial markets and the larger economy, and argue effectively that this is fine. Cyclicality, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's very healthy for there to be an ebb and a flow. And remembering a conversation that we had with Tomas Sedlacek, where he suggested that it's just not healthy to try to have only good days. Sometimes you have good days, sometimes you have bad days. Of course, he was referencing our emotional lives. And I think that this, too, is the case where central banks have basically been trying to give us some form of Zoloft or Wellbutrin or some sort of mood-enhancing drug so that we never experience the ebb, but only the flow.
Dave, I think you've used Joseph as an example as far as cyclicality goes. You know, seven lean years, seven healthy years, seven lean years again. We see cyclicality all through history. We also see it through the Bible.
You know, one of the interesting conversations as we were standing out at a barbecue, a number of people gathered for a barbecue yesterday, and the conference was over, and we stood out and looked over the Indian Ocean and had a conversation. Had a conversation about what kinds of storehouses did I have in mind. And this conversation was with a business owner from Indonesia, one of the largest business owners in all of Indonesia, and both in the natural resource space, but also with business interests across a wide array of areas within the Indonesian and Asian economy. And we talked about a number of things. We talked about the obvious financial storehouses. Well, first, just a word on what a storehouse is. You know, going back to that Old Testament idea of putting grain into the storehouse, it did not go into the storehouse in order to sit there, in order to rot. There's a difference between a storehouse and a hoard. And Joseph was not hoarding. Joseph put something away so that in the future he could put it to good use. And that's exactly what he did. He took everything that was in the storehouse and put it to good use. And so when I think about the nature of a storehouse from a financial standpoint, that is the role that gold plays to some degree. As a cash equivalent or as a cash alternative, it represents a storehouse, not a hoarding of assets, but something that does allow for future productive use. So that was one of the things that we talked about in this conversation as we looked over the Indian Ocean, listening to the waves crash on the shore. By the way, I would not have gone into that water for a swim. Of course, there's many parts of this part of the world where the largest of the largest great whites love to feed on seals and anything that resembles a seal. So we looked at the water, but did not tip our toes in. I take that back. My son did tip his toes in, but with very clear instructions to not swim, just to let the water lap up on his ankles.
And that's good to hear that, Dave, because, you know, it's your inclination normally to jump in the water with sharks. I have pictures that you've sent me when you were in Hawaii, and, you know, even encourage your son that he shouldn't be afraid of sharks. So it's good to hear. I realize that that west coast of South Africa, it's got the largest great whites, you know, in the world. But I want to go back to what you were talking about on the storehouse, because I think that's a fascinating concept, Dave. So much preparation or prepper type of behavior is motivated on exactly what you said, hoarding, which is fear-based. Okay, there's a fear of a lack of future security. Whereas what you're talking about, productive use of a storehouse, is very different. That is faith-based activity. In other words, you have faith in moving forward and that that storehouse will someday be replenished again sometime. And I look at the central banks right now. In a way, the central banks have behaved so poorly because there's a fear that we'll never be able to make it back again. So we better go ahead and just carry on the debt. You know, a little like what we talked about with Richard Duncan last week. You know, we're so deep in debt at this point that we better continue to go further. What's your thought on that as it relates to a storehouse?
Well, I think just one, to come full circle to the conversation that we had with Richard, I don't think the solution is throwing even more amounts of money at it. I was just in a room full of doers and makers, and that's different than people who know how to print funny money and know how to take from others and redistribute. We were in a room where ideas were batted around, again, about education, about entrepreneurship, about specific poverty issues, both in Africa and in Asia and throughout the world, and looking at some really fundamental development issues. And the answer in every instance was not throwing money at the problems. That was not it at all. That, in fact, would have been a laughable solution because we now have a solid record, not just decades, but near centuries of experimentation with throwing money at social and poverty and development issues. And we still have those issues in the same countries where that's been experimented with. An investment in human resources, the development and mentorship of individuals, that is a very different thing. And again, you're dealing with people who know how to build teams that were at this conference. You're dealing with people who know how to build corporations. You're dealing with a different kind of spirit altogether. And so, you know, the idea of looking at Joseph's storehouses and saying, well, sure, there's a time when you need to put more away, those seven fat years, in anticipation of seven lean. But there are these other storehouses which are just as relevant. We can talk about the physical financial storehouse of gold, but we can also, I think, benefit from looking at the other kinds of storehouses, things like developing an emotional storehouse. Do you have excess emotional capacity? What is your bandwidth? What is your bandwidth at an emotional level, at an intellectual level, at a spiritual level? Are you able to give and give and give beyond what you would normally be able to give in a context where you're dealing with not just a lack of food, but a lack of other resources as well? Kevin, if we're right about there being some challenging times financially ahead, then it's as important or more important to consider what is in your storehouses. And again, that's on a very broad basis, not just the financial piece.
Well, and David, we've talked in the past about resiliency, and resiliency is sort of a broad word, but it's becoming in vogue, you know, instead of preparation, become resilient. And I think this is more what you're leaning toward at this point. You're saying you need to have storehouses emotionally. We know you have to have a storehouse spiritually, a storehouse physically, a storehouse with legacy with your family. You know, your book that has just come out in first copy print that actually will be available for everyone in November is about legacy. That's building a storehouse in future generations and taking from the knowledge that you've gained from past generations. I think this is what you're talking about, isn't it? Resiliency in all forms.
Well, certainly at a relational level, I remember reading a book maybe a decade or more ago where it talked about, in the context of relationships, adding to an emotional bank, a love bank, if you will, knowing that at some point there may be withdrawals and you never want to get to a point where you are at a zero balance or overdraw the account. You always add to those emotional reserves in anticipation of a day where they may be drawn down. And again, you don't want to go negative. I can't help but reflect on where I'm at. 25 to 30 years ago, I was here with my father, and I brought my eldest son with me on this trip, and it was an absolutely fantastic trip, to paint a picture for him of the transitions that have taken place in South Africa and the things that have changed and the things that have not changed. It's very interesting because we had many opportunities to visit with people across the political spectrum here in South Africa and to learn what the frustrations are with the current regime in power. The ANC has been in power since the transition roughly 22 years ago, and they originally followed the visions of Nelson Mandela, and it was a very bright and hopeful period in that period of time. And Thabo Mbeki took the baton and took it farther as an administrator, not necessarily someone with the vision of Mandela, but as a reasonable, even-handed administrator. And now with Jacob Zuma, we have the third generation, if you will. And just like in a legacy, very rarely does a legacy live past the third generation. We find a wasted opportunity. We find resources squandered. We find a man who was given a birthright and he sold it for less than a mess of pottage. He has wasted an opportunity. The time that he has been in office, he has stolen funds. There are no less than 750 charges against him, corruption charges, and yet he will probably be reelected. Why? Because the alternatives, one with the DA party, is viewed by many in the country as a front for the old apartheid regime. And it's not, but that is the way it's viewed. And people will say yes, and where they have become dominant, that is the DA party, the trains run on time. It's very safe. It's very clean. And where the ANC is dominant, it's treacherous. It's dirty. It's not well managed. Because what has happened is, just like perhaps a third generation child who inherits a massive amount of wealth, but is not prepared for it, does not have the character to manage it well, they've sat back and basically taken and taken and taken and stolen and stolen and stolen from their own people. So you now have a reaction to that from within the ANC, a brand new party, the EFF. And this is Julius Malema, and he represents a new and radical shift, but it's a shift to the left. And he's made many statements that would have you, as someone who's aware of history on this continent and in the southern part of the continent, be concerned that Johannesburg could become the new Harare, and we could be looking at, if the EFF were to come to power, the same kinds of nightmarish stories that have taken place north of here in Zimbabwe.
Last year, Dave, when you were meeting this same group of men in Singapore, you met Craig Deal and In Freeth, who had land taken away and family members lost with the horrors that had occurred in Rhodesia before it became Zimbabwe. You're saying this radical shift to the left in South Africa, if it continues, could lead to things similar to that?
And that's really only if the EFF party comes into power and replaces the ANC. And so it's complicated. People are preferring the corrupt evil that they know as opposed to really the evil that they don't know with the EFF. And so it could go that direction, but my guess is that we have another period of sort of status quo with the ANC, with Jacob Zuma, and it does not become more radical. It just stays as corrupt as it has been. So you're dealing with leadership that is lazy, that is entitled, that is, quite frankly, dealing with some of the transitional issues that you saw similar in India after they gained independence from Britain after about 3 or 4 decades. They went through a period of soul searching and significant change politically in that same time frame. It was growing pains, I guess you could say. Now, the problem with growing pains in South Africa is they don't have the wind at their backs. They don't have the wind at their backs financially. We have all of your BRIC countries and many of your other commodity-producing emerging market countries, which are not emerging, they are submerging. They have been stuck with the resource blessing, which is also a resource curse, and they've not diversified their economy enough. I mean, think about this. In the 1970s and 80s, when we traveled to this country very frequently as a family, they were 70% of the world's total gold production in a very wealthy, well-run country. Today, they produce less than 10% of total gold production, and their largest export is wine. Now, there's nothing wrong with exporting wine, and as a matter of fact, they make some wonderful wines, which we've enjoyed while we were here in country. But here's the issue. That is an entirely discretionary export. It's something that you watch the global economy ebb and flow, and it will have an impact in places like Bordeaux. It'll have an impact on places like Napa Valley. It'll have an impact on places like Stellenbosch, the wine region here in Southern Africa. And it's because, again, these are discretionary dollars. And when things get tight, people don't buy as nice a wine. People don't buy wine as often. It's one of those first things to go. So I think we're back to looking at the world struggle for some part of the global economy. And I remember it was about a year ago, we had Tomáš Sedláček on the program, and he said an economy tells us much more about itself when it expresses its weakness, not when it's at full strength. Do you remember when we had that conversation? He said, we can get to know it much better when it's bare and humble than when it overflows with pride and despises everything other than itself. Strength frequently hides the essences of things, while weakness reveals it. And we have that here in Africa, but I think we also have it in the global economy as well.
Well, and I would like to go ahead and shift to the global economy at this point, because we got the GDP numbers here in America last week, and they were sorely disappointing. And that comes right on the heels of getting the durable goods orders, which was also sorely disappointing. I mean, talking about economic weakness revealing your true self, we seem to have no wind at our back either here in America right now. And now that we're getting close to zero interest rates, we're starting to see that without an economic restart with easy money, we're probably not going to have an economic restart without a depression or a recession of sorts, are we not?
You know, we just finished the Democratic National Convention, and the view there was that the economy was doing very well. And that's an idea that Mr. Obama has been a champion of. And at the DNC, the pom-poms were out waving, celebrating the fact that U.S. was going from strength to strength. And in point of fact, we are today the one bright spot in the global economy. And, you know, contrast that with 2 years ago, where the assumption was that China would lead us out of recession and into a strong global performance at an economic level. And so the themes that we've been fed, whether it was the emerging markets, which would pull us out, China, which would pull us out. So the U.S. is the singular bright spot, except for one thing. We have an earnings recession, which in every instance of the past, when you've had a major earnings recession, you've ended up with a bear market in stocks. And yet the stock market trades near all-time highs, with the average investor either out and glad to be out of the market or absolutely clueless about the dangers inherent in their stock portfolios. As you mentioned, GDP figures came out this last week, and we're not so bright. Up 1.2% versus what was expected, 2.6%. And if you look at that on a year-on-year basis, this is where you have to say, we are on alert, on high alert for recession. Add to that what we had with the durable goods orders. We were expected to be down 1.3%, and we were down even more than that. We were down 4% last week, looking at the durable goods numbers. What does that indicate? It indicates that we have very weak business spending. And if business executives were enthusiastic about the direction of the world economy and the direction of consumers, the growth of their businesses, would they be ramping up for it? Would they be gearing up for it? Would they be spending in anticipation of it? And the answer is yes, yes, yes. But what we have in the numbers is quite the opposite. No, it's not happening. Business spending is not attractive at all. You've got JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, who both have suggested in the last 10 days that it might be time to move to the sidelines for a couple of months. And that's specifically talking about equity investments. And I just want to say, we've had that conversation, have suggested it for some time, that it's not warranted. The risk in the market does not warrant any possible reward that you might get from it. And that, quite frankly, it's okay to miss out on some growth occasionally, particularly when you have such a radical disconnect between asset prices and economic fundamentals. So one of the most helpful things that came from last week's conversation with Richard Duncan was that distinction between capitalism and creditism. And I think it is clear that capitalism is dead and that we're addicted to credit. As addicts to credit, as beneficiaries of easy money policy, it's worth noting the dangerous territory that we're in. You've got the S&P, which is at new all-time highs. You've got the NASDAQ, which is at 16-year highs. And yet, if you look at the sell signals, which came from a technical standpoint, looking at the MACD last week, and you look at the volumes, which are not increasing on the other side of a technical breakout. So let me just repeat this. You've got the S&P at all-time highs, the NASDAQ at 16-year highs, and yet the volumes, which should be following through and driving the price even higher, they're not there.
And that's always been an indicator in the past. When you have dropping volume and rising prices, that's always been an indicator that you're coming into a correction period.
That's right. So it looks to me like this is a time to be nimble as an investor. That was one of the challenges and suggestions made by an asset manager here in South Africa. Didn't take quite as a bearish view as we have. Agreed in principle with where we're at and where we're going, but suggested just being nimble. And I think that's absolutely correct. My one counterpoint to that notion of being nimble is just this. We always assume that we'll get out when we can or when we should get out. And my suggestion is, if you register concerns with economic fundamentals in the picture, weak at present as they are, don't try to be the last man out and maximize every last dime of possible return. Be a little early. It's better to be a little early than even a second late. So, look, one of the things that I can't help but reflect on being here in South Africa is the massive difference in the exchange rate. When you look at currency values, it's really helpful to step back and, with a 30-year perspective, know that the currency is telling you a very important story. If you look at the current moves in the Rand, they were very, very weak, and actually in the last few months have improved. So you might say, well, things are getting better, right? This is why it's important to step back and see the forest instead of just looking at the trees. When I was here traveling with my father, the exchange rate was between 3.5 and 4 to 1. And on a 3.5 to 4 to 1 exchange rate, we would bring investors down here to South Africa, and those tours were 5-star across the board. And of course, they cost the equivalent of 25 cents on the dollar. Today, the exchange rate is not 4 to 1, but 14.5 to 1. And it's been as bad as 19. And so the long view is that in spite of a positive change politically from apartheid to a more fair system today, the opportunity to advance the country has been squandered. And the stock, if you will, of the country, that is the currency of the country, tells all. Not only have they been downgraded time and time again in the debt markets, but their currency tells you that what could have happened here in Southern Africa and been an example for the whole continent, again, has been an opportunity that's been squandered. I don't know when, I don't know how that opportunity will arise again. Certainly won't be under the leadership of Jacob Zuma. But nevertheless, I think as we look at our own situation in the United States, it's helpful to get these mile markers, the exchange rate, if you will, over time, because on a day-in, day-out basis, you don't really know where you're at. Are we up a dollar? Are we down a dollar? Are we up 1 point relative to the euro? Are we down 1 point? It's too much information, and it doesn't really contain anything of meaning. But if you can step back and say, actually, the U.S. dollar has been on a similar trend for nearly 20 years, what does that say? Well, in this case, we're getting the benefit of being the one bright spot on the planet. And as the one bright spot on the planet, the U.S. dollar is stronger than it would otherwise be, as we've seen flight capital out of the emerging markets and even weaker economies into our own economy and into our own currency. Does that last forever? Not.
David, I can't help but remember what we talked about a couple of weeks ago when you talked about that exchange rate difference in South Africa. You know, I still think of the Krugerrands that your dad would have had in his pocket. You know, 1 ounce of gold worth a certain amount of rand, worth a certain amount of dollars. Now those Krugerrands today are worth four times in South African rand what they were before. And they're worth just about three or four times in U.S. dollars what they were before. It depends on the time frame that you're looking at. So when you're talking about stepping back, you have to have something, a consistent measuring rod to measure things with. And it just seems to me like the person who would have stayed in gold during these periods of time of uncertainty, not necessarily as a prepper, but as a person, like you're saying, who stays nimble, watches the change, and then employs the difference. You know, you could sell that Krugerrand today and actually create a business opportunity when the opportunity presents itself.
In front of me, I have a Mining Weekly. It's a news rag that's published here in South Africa. And of course, they still do a lot of mining here. And one of the editorials, about a 4 or 5 page article, discusses gold as a hedge against uncertainty. And it goes into the World Gold Council's comments here in the last week or so that gold is attracting a brand new class of investor. And they're seeking it because of its quality. They're seeking it because of its liquidity. They're seeking it as a hedge against market uncertainty. And of course, it's always played a role where there is weakness in an economy or where there is strange goings on at the level of politics or intervention. This is interesting because you're dealing with sophisticated investors as this new class of investor into gold who look and say, what about intervention risk? What about political risk? What about economic risk? Not just market uncertainty, but look at all the interventions in the marketplace today. How do you make heads and tails of that and create some sort of a hedge position against major systemic upset? We had more of the same in terms of bank intervention from the Bank of Japan here in recent days, where they've decided to double their ETF purchase scheme. That is, the central bank is stepping into the stock market to buy stocks and monetize stocks, thus boosting the stock market. Now, you tell me if these kinds of behaviors, interventionist behavior on the parts of central banks all around the world, does not merit individual investors. And in this case, the World Gold Council and this particular mining magazine is suggesting this. This is where gold gains traction again, where people say, you can't make heads and tails out of interventionism, and the only way to hedge against a blow-up is to have some exposure to something that will last even when the dust settles.
Well, that's great advice. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can give us a call anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.